We drive home. I run into our apartment. Just as I am about to open the door, it opens all by itself, and there, beaming with joy, "Oh, how in the world did you get here?" is little Bugger. But he isn't little anymore. He's grown up, even though quite young. He smiles as sweetly as ever, bows before me and kisses my hand. "How good, how very good to see you come home again, my queen," he says quietly. But I stand there looking at him in sheer astonishment. "Bugger, you're here? How did you get here?" I ask. Now it's his turn to be surprised. "But you know that I've been living here for the last 3 years. In your house. Why do you ask?" "I just can't understand it. He isn't exactly as I've known him. He's already grown up, yet I know that he's really still a child. Or should be still a child. But why? Since he's come from his far away homeland, I just don't know him. And even then he was already a grown-up young man. Why do I have a strange feeling that he's only a boy of 10 or 12? Why do I feel again as if I were dreaming? And here's my husband. The whole apartment is full of flowers. How sweet of him to welcome me home after all these years of our being married, in the same sweet way he did during the first few days of our honeymoon. After supper we sit near a strange, fairly large wooden box in which a human voice is speaking. The voice tells us the latest news of the war, along with rules and regulations for us to follow. How strange. This is another materialization of a mental process, like the telepathic apparatus up there in the little forest house. Tahotep, my dear master, also emits high energy radiations through the atmosphere of the country every evening. All the people, while they sleep, are aided and strengthened by his powers and his love. But his radiations reach into the very depths of people's beings, not just to the outer ears like the low-frequency vibrations coming from this odd little wooden box here. Then we all go to bed. And in many of the nights that follow we are suddenly awakened by a horrible sound. Sirens howl throughout the whole city. We jump out of bed, slip into our shoes, warm underwear, a house dress, a fur, a warm kerchief around our head. We snatch up the little suitcase with jewelry and money and the old album with the symbolic mystic drawings. We rush downstairs, my husband and I, down into the cellar. On the stairway we meet my younger sister with her newborn babe in arms, her three-year-old boy and two-year soft-old girl. Other doors open up into the stairway, and other people come out, blanched and drawn and silent, to join us on our downward march. As we reach the ground floor, a door opens and an old man with snow-white hair and beard comes out. Those eyes. Where have I seen these eyes before? And like a flash of lightning, I suddenly see again the handsome figure of my father's general, the one who made such a fine career for himself, Thistha. His eyes. And how has he come here? And how old he is? And how do I come to be whispering to him now, "Father dear, are you dressed warm enough?" He smiles and gives me a reassuring wave of the hand. "Yes, yes, don't worry." And we all go on to find our place in the cellar. The enemy comes closer and closer. The ring of steel he's forged around our city gets tighter and tighter. One afternoon the door opens and Emma walks in. "How does he come to be here? And dressed in this clothing?" I embrace him and ask, "What kind of a suit is that?" He looks at me with equal surprise. "What a question, mother," he says. "What kind of a suit? Why, mother, you act as if you were seeing me in it for the first time. An Air Force uniform. But you've known that for a long time." I stand there just as confused as if I were about to awaken from another dream. "Yes, of course, an Air Force uniform. And he is my darling, my only child. And yet I know that he's Ima. Of course I know him. Ima. Is he really my son?" I can still see him clearly in his priestly robe. He gave me lessons in concentration. Even then his radiation was as strong and clean as steel. I know him. But he doesn't know me and acts as if he had never had anything to do with the temple. "Mother," he says, My outfit is moving on to another place, because our planes can't operate anymore from this airfield. If we stayed here any longer, we'd all be destroyed with our aircraft. We're moving on somewhere into the countryside. I don't know when I'll see you again. My heart turns cold in panic. I've already got used to knowing my son was in constant danger. When he went into the Air Force, I felt as if I'd been struck dead. I walked around lifelessly in the apartment, feeling as if I were dreaming a horrible dream. How could that be reality? How could mothers really be sending their sons, their healthy, young, vigorous sons out into this mass murder? It's certainly only a bad dream in which people have become so depraved and so degraded as to be killing each other with the most gruesome weapons imaginable. And killing off precisely the healthiest, strongest, fittest young men. Young men who should be begetting a new, strong, healthy generation of people. These young men are the first to get killed simply because they are considered fit for service. The weak and sickly ones stay home, and because they do, they are the very ones who can become fathers. The majority of healthy young people are killed off in the fighting. This is the fastest road to the complete degeneration of the entire human race. And people have already sunk so low they don't even recognize this fact. For no other reason than blind hate and fear of each other, people kill off the best and healthiest generation. Dream. Nightmare. Then, little by little, my sense of reality came back, and I turned my child over to God. Nothing can happen without God's will, and whatever happens is good because God wants it so. Compensation. Everything that happens is only a searching and striving to return to equilibrium. Back to paradise. These words of my dear master, Tahotep, and all the other things he taught me in the Great Pyramid made such a deep impression on me that this gave me courage to go on living, to go on doing my daily duties, despite the terrible realization that my child and millions of others were using each other as targets in this mass butchery. But now I knew that we would be separated when he left the city, for the enemy had us almost completely surrounded. And whether he or we would come out of this mass murder alive, or whether we would see each other again in this life, these were all just big question marks. And still I cannot, I must not feel pain, because I am not permitted to link myself with anyone in such a way that my happiness is dependent on him. In this young man whom I carried under my heart in order that he might be born again, in this young man who is now my son, I do not love the body. It is not his physical manifestation I love, but God within him. His divine self has built up this body, just like the bodies of all people, animals, plants and even inert matter, in order to be able to express itself. So it's the manifestation of the impersonal divinity I love in my son's person, in his beautiful body. All of creation is the manifestation of the one and only God, so why should I now tremble about the possibility of losing this particular manifestation of God? Why should I shudder at the thought of not seeing it again? Perhaps because his flesh and his blood are from my flesh and my blood? But myself and his self are the same self, and not flesh and blood at all. I must go into my own self and become fully conscious in it. Then I am identical with the self of my son, and at the same time with the self of the entire universe, and so I cannot lose anything or anyone. It cannot make any difference to me whether those who die are of my own flesh and blood or total strangers, because the same self of God is changing one of its many bodies whenever a living creature dies, whether it's the body of my one and only child or someone I don't know at all. I must completely conquer my flesh and blood, which now feels such terrible pain. Oh God, give me the strength to pass this test. Even though I haven't yet attained cosmic consciousness, give me the strength to act as if I were living every moment in this divine state of consciousness. My knees tremble as I go to my son, embrace him and say, "My dear little boy, my one and only child, farewell. I put you in God's hands. He won't leave either you or us. Just remember that everything passes away except true love. Even now we love each other because we are one in God. This spiritual unity, this true love, has brought us together here on earth. We can't lose each other. We will find each other and meet again. If not in this life, then in the next, or in another form of life. Wherever we may go, our love for each other will bring us together again. Farewell, my darling. In difficult times to come, hold on to this invisible power that stands behind us and never leaves us. The power we call God. Neither of us cries. We hold each other in a long, warm, loving embrace. I kiss his smooth, young forehead. He holds me to his heart, then leaves. I wave to him from the window. He waves back, then disappears. Tonight we celebrate Christmas. The cannons are thundering continually, but still we make all the preparations we can to celebrate the day as beautifully as possible. It doesn't matter much to me, for in eternity there are no Christmases, no holidays, and no weekdays. Every day is a holiday, a holy day, because in God eternity is an everlasting, holy day. But my husband likes to celebrate Christmas Eve. He is happy when he can give me pleasant surprises, and he likes to be surprised himself. He is already decorating the tree in the parlor, and Bogar is helping him. For the last several weeks, Bogar has been living with us. Even if he wanted to go home evenings, he would not have been able to do so recently because of the heavy bombings. He lives in the room my son has vacated. Several years ago, Bogar left his homeland far away in the Orient. He came to the West to teach people in this part of the world the ancient science of his ancestors, which enables people to bring the body under the dominion of the spirit. After wartime shortages made it impossible to obtain stone or bronze for sculpturing purposes, my studio was empty and I turned it over to Bogar as a room in which to give his lessons. From the beginning of our acquaintanceship, he acted as if he were our own child, and now he and my husband are decorating the Christmas tree in the greatest of harmony. I am with the cook trying to think up ways and means to prepare a festive menu with the food supplies we've succeeded in obtaining with so much difficulty. Today we've been invited with the whole family for Christmas Eve supper at Father's, and tomorrow we'll need to be able to serve a Christmas meal ourselves. Then the doorbell rings. My young cousin rushes in, all white and shaken. "Esther," he says, "the enemy has completely surrounded the city, and their troops are making a surprise move. They're not coming from the other side of the city where we expected them, but straight in. Straight towards us." I was in the city with Father and we telephoned Mother. She told us the enemy troops have already reached our villa. Their heavy tanks and men are moving towards the center of the city. Lucky thing the telephone lines weren't cut. Enemy tanks and troops will probably be here any minute. Get ready. Now I've got to run. Goodbye. And with that he goes. I run to my husband to tell him the news, then on through all the house spreading the alarm, so that my sisters, brother, father, and the caretaker's family all know what we're up against. Our villa stands on a hillside. From our windows we can see far down the street in the direction from which the enemy troops are coming. Everything is quiet for the moment. My husband says it may be hours before the enemy reaches our vicinity. So he suggests we celebrate Christmas immediately, then go downstairs to Father's where we've been invited to join all the rest of the family for supper. That way, we'll all be together at Father's and can wait and watch for further developments. My husband lights the candles on the Christmas tree. I think of my son who at this very moment may be obliged to take part in an air raid. I commend him to God's care. We all shake hands, exchange presents, leave everything lying where it happens to be, and hurry down to Father's flat. "Children," says Father, "let's eat quickly, for we may soon have to take refuge in the cellar." We sit down. As has been the custom since my mother died, her chair stands at one end of the table, empty, and a candle is burning at her place. Thoughtfully, quietly and calmly we eat our supper. We all feel that a solemn, somber time is coming soon when we will be face to face with our destiny. While supper is still in progress, a bomb goes off with a mighty blast right near our windows. We all look at each other. "Let's go right on eating," says Father, maybe we can finish supper. We eat as fast as possible, but the explosions come closer and closer and get more and more frequent. The doorbell rings. Officers of the Federal Army are standing in front of the door. We're going to set up our cannon in the garden, one of them says, and we're going to billet our troops in your house. Give us the keys to all the flats in the house. My husband gets up to show the officers around. We hear a particularly loud explosion. The whole house is shaken as if by an earthquake. A few minutes later my husband comes back. Father, he says, we'd better get down to the cellar. The garage has been hit. Our central heating plant has been damaged. We've got to turn it off immediately and drain out the water. Get below, all of you, your lives aren't safe anymore in the flat. The enemy troops must be very near now. The officers are saying the enemy has already reached the other side of the street. The fighting won't last long, but still we must expect to spend the next few days in the cellar. Thoughtfully and with perfect calm, Father says, let the women and children all go below. I'm going to finish eating my supper. Please bring the coffee. We know there is no arguing with Father. My younger sister gets up and takes her baby into her arms. I take her little boy by the hand, and my other sister takes the little girl. Together we go downstairs to the underground shelter. My brother, my husband and Bogard stay with Father for coffee. The explosions keep getting louder and stronger. Sitting in the cellar, we feel the house shaking in its foundations every time. After a while, the heavy iron door opens, and the men come in. Stepping over to me, my husband whispers in a low voice so that no one else can hear, they're putting up cannon in our garden, and they intend to defend our house to the very last. They refuse to give up the city. Our house is in a key spot for them. If the enemy troops take it, there will be no way to stop them from here right down to the river. We can expect they'll fight to the very last man. I only hope it won't last long. The city is completely surrounded, and any further resistance will simply entail senseless destruction. I'm going to get the janitor to help me bring down all our mattresses so that we can get some sleep. And with that he leaves. Even the longest night is followed by dawn, and so this night can ease to an end too. The iron door opens and closes continually, as our menfolk come and go. Soldiers come in too occasionally and try to warm up a little. Outside a blizzard is raging and the thermometer stands at 15 degrees below zero. It's cold in our cellar too. We sit there in all the clothes we can put on underneath our fur coats. There's no heat anywhere in the house now. The soldiers are mere boys. Pale and trembling with cold and fright, they get ordered out into battle with brutal unconcern by the older officers. Poor children. They're not older than 16 or 18 and have already been dragged away from home into this mass murder. We try to rest, but the little baby yells so loud and long not one of us can sleep a wink. The next morning my father comes in looking surprisingly pale. Children, he says, the water main has been hit. Go easy on what you use. There isn't any more water in the house. With that he goes out. We hear the men outside talking about the possibility of bringing in water from somewhere else. All the water in the water pipes throughout the house is drained out into basins and bathtubs. Down here in our rear aid shelter, we have a big wooden barrel full of water for firefighting purposes. Are we going to have to drink this old, stale, smelly water? My younger sister looks at me inquiringly. I know she's thinking about her babe in arms. Ever since her husband disappeared, her own milk ceased flowing. From that time on, her babe was fed cooked food. But for that we have to have water. And the baby's bottle has to be thoroughly washed between feeds. I try to calm her fears by whispering, "It's snowing, we'll melt snow to make water." My husband hears me and calls me out into the room outside the shelter. Do you realize how little water you can get out of snow? The soldiers are taking all our water away. Unless we want to die of thirst, we'll have to get water from somewhere. We could go a long time without food, But without water the heart is affected. We have to have water. There are 26 adults in the house, and we can't even cook beans if we don't have water. I'm going out to try to find water somewhere in the neighborhood, he says, and leaves. A short while later he comes back and reports, the houses all along the street haven't any water either. We'll have to go with buckets and carry water from the next through street. Please don't go, I answer him, the machine gun fire is too terrible, and cannon and airplanes are shooting continually too. You might get hit. Stay here and wait. My husband smiles, don't be a child. The First World War wasn't fought with cap pistols, and I still came through all right. God will not forsake us. Whatever is going to happen will happen anyway. I embrace him and he disappears behind the cellar door. I go back into the shelter and sit down. And wait. Quiet and cold, I wait. If it's God's will for my husband to come back, no bullet will hit him. If not, then it had to be that way. Things are never bad, it's how you think about them. I heard a voice in my heart. I tell myself that hundreds and thousands, even millions of wives are sitting somewhere, just as I am, praying for their husbands. These husbands are men like mine. The fact that my person loves his person so deeply is a manifestation of the self, which is the same in every person. When two people love each other, it means they are experiencing the unity of the self in their consciousness. They feel they belong together because they are one in the self. I quiet my trembling heart, but it still goes on trembling. Keep calm, I tell it. Steady does it. Just beat slowly and calmly. Now let's breathe slowly and deeply, still deeper, and still deep. Keep calm. We all of us have to put away the body someday. 100 years from now it won't matter a bit who went first. Time and space are inventions of the intellect. But the spirit, the self, stands above the intellect, above all thoughts, above any concept of time and space. Breathe calmly and regularly and think of nothing. Just be. I don't know how long I've been sitting there, when the door opens again, and there is my husband with 10 quarts of water. Water. Wonderful water, one all of us, 26 people have enough of it to last a day. I don't stand up, and I don't throw myself about his neck. No, the great moments are always very simple. No sobbing, no tears, and no big words. From where he stands, portioning out the water, my husband glances over at me. Our eyes meet and we understand each other perfectly. I think to myself, reprieve. How long? We sit in the cellar, in darkness. Outside the thunderous fire continues unremittingly. The earth trembles beneath, and we have to hold onto the bench below so that we are not thrown bodily to the floor. Cannon and tanks put up a steady barrage of fire. Airplanes roar past overhead. Bombs scream down and burst. The barrage of fire goes on and on. How long have we been sitting here in the cellar? By now I've lost all feeling for time. There is no day or night in the cellar. It's always dark. A dim little light is all we are allowed. We've had no electricity for a long time, and we have to husband our supply of oil. Whenever the barrage of fire stops for a half hour, we step out into the other cellar room and have something to eat. We are lucky to have laid in a supply of emergency rations. But all too often we have to stop eating suddenly and rush back into the shelter, for our house is now getting shot at from the other side too. After every hit, we hear tiles and beams from the roof and upper walls falling down on the ceiling above us. We never know whether or not the next blast will cause the ceiling to cave in and bury us all alive. One day a deafening blast blows a huge hole in the wall of the next room in the cellar. Fortunately, it's not in our shelter. Later, during a lull in the barrage of fire outside, my husband goes out to see what's happened. A gigantic hole gapes in the cellar wall. The bright sunshine streaming through it makes us both blink. Tile and bricks lie all about us. Splinters of wood, bits of tree, everything covered by a heavy layer of dust. And on one end of a beam that sticks up out of the general mess and confusion, a hen, also covered with a heavy layer of dust, stand there on one leg, just as calmly as if nothing had happened. She's one of Father's chickens, the only one left. Poor animal. What an awful opinion it must have of us human beings. A few days later, the cook's art has turned the hen into a delicious soup. While we're eating it, we discover how badly injured it was. Its leg bone had been shot through, and part of the leg was missing. That's why it stood there on one leg. With what stoic patience and indifference it bore up under its injury, not letting out so much as a squawk or a cackle to tell how much it was suffering. Hour after hour we go on sitting in the shelter. Will the barrage of fire outside never stop? I hold my sister's little boy on my lap. My body is cold with fright, for even though a human being may face death with calm and quiet in his spirit, the body revolts. We don't know whether we may be hit by a bomb, buried alive, or die of thirst. The little boy begs me, "Tell me a story, Aunt Esther, tell me a story." And I tell him stories by the hour to keep him quiet. He holds a toy automobile in his hand, and it's my job to wind it up again and again. While he plays, he sings a little song. It sounds so familiar. What's the name of it? Now I remember. It's the song the little pig sings, "Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf?" In one of Walt Disney's films. Oh! How lucky I am that it's dark here in the cellar. Nobody can see that I've lost control of myself, and big soggy tears roll down over my cheeks. God! Oh God! You are present with us here. Your sacred message tells us all we mustn't be afraid. Aunt Esther, tell me some more. Tell me what happened then. Why have you stopped telling the story? Asks little Peter. I hold the dear boy close to my heart and go on with the story, and the little goat's mother came back and. After seeming me endless hours the barrage of fire stops. Just as he's been doing day after day, my husband goes out to get water. When he comes back, he waves to me. Esther. He says all shaken and in a voice trembling with emotion, I've just been upstairs in our flat. The beautiful furniture you carved yourself, and all your lovely sculptured figures are a total wreck. The floor of one room is gone and so are the walls of the other rooms. We haven't a home anymore. And the poor dear boy drops his head on my shoulder, crying and sobbing like a baby. I embrace him in his heavy winter coat. Don't cry. What really matters is that we're alive. We're still alive and uninjured in the midst of all this destruction. I can always make new figures. Don't worry about material things. Life stands over everything. He tries hard to control himself. I loved all your carvings. The whole apartment. So very, very much. And now everything's gone. All gone. No matter, even this hell will come to an end someday. I lay my head for a moment on his broad shoulder. We embrace each other tenderly, then go back into the dark shelter. This is no time to be sentimental. Bogar comes and whispers, "What's happened? We heard the roof and walls falling in up where your apartment is." I tell him what my husband has just told me. Bogar, the ever calm, ever smiling, gets all excited. "I'm going up there. I have to salvage my slides and film on yoga. My life's work will be ruined if they're destroyed. I'm going up." Bogar, you mustn't. Enemy sharpshooters will pick you off in a minute. I won't let you go up. My brother hears our conversation. "I'll go up there with Bogar," he says. "I'll help him." Together they leave the cellar. We wait anxiously. Minute after minute goes by. A quarter hour. An hour. We're still waiting. Finally the door opens, and Bogar and my brother come in, dusty and dirty but beaming with success. In their hands they hold the precious boxes of slides and reels of film. My brother tells us, the walls have all caved in, but the cupboard was still standing in the corner on a little piece of floor. We had to get over to the cupboard, but there wasn't any floor left to walk on, only an iron beam. And we had to watch out that the sharpshooters across the street didn't see us. So both of us lay down and crawled across the beam. Boga dug out all the boxes from the cupboard and handed them over to me, one after the other. Now we've got everything.